Welcome to Virginia Voice's presentation of the Braille Monitor. I'm Corrine Hardison, Virginia Voice volunteer, and today I'll be reading from the April 2024 issue of the Braille Monitor. Our first article today, Red, White, and Blind, Your Way, If Not My Way, Towards Serving, by Kyle Ryan Kipper. From the editor. At last, here's an article about the ways we can serve a country that for too long has said no thanks, no place for you, no way for you to help in the jobs that add to our defense and help save lives. Though this is what we were told when we asked, it seems there were and are alternatives. Here's the story of Kyle Ryan Kipper, a man who lives in Texas and who has found ways to serve his country and offers us his story and some recommended alternatives. During my first 2 decades as a vocational rehabilitation counselor, I have always been heartened by the eagerness of people who were blind or live with other disabilities to do their part, often including a very strong wish to serve their country as a member of the military or as a first responder. We are Americans, and just like that 1% who serve in uniform, we match that statistic in desire and in a goal to remove barriers and improve these vital institutions. Most likely, we're even more motivated because someone with low expectations and a lack of scope has told us we cannot do it. Per my observation, this enthusiasm to join crosses all ages and impairment demographics, whether physical, sensory, psychological, developmental, intellectual, or most often a combination of some or all of the above. More times than I can count, after my first adult decade pops up in conversation or someone sees my memorabilia in my office, I have been told by my clients, "You are so lucky to have been able to do that." I agree, but most of them have opportunities too, for there is a way for them to do their bit as well. But they should follow my advice and not my example. When I was about 8 years of age, I watched for the first of 1,000 times the John Wayne classic, Sands of Iwo Jima. Right then and there, I determined to become a United States Marine. Because I lost my father at an early age, my mother signed me up for the Big Brother program. I was matched with a U.S. Army Ranger Mustang second lieutenant. For most of the next 10 years, he prepared, educated, and trained me to be successful in the military, in spite of his humorous competitive disgust at my Marine Corps aspirations. But my dreams were shattered when the Navy physician unilaterally disqualified me from all branches due to my family ophthalmologist's notation of a diagnosis of retinitis pigmentosa in my chart. The ensuing months were not good. I became depressed and got into trouble with the law. My family saved me, both from jail and my dilemma. My sister introduced me to the American Red Cross, where I quickly dove in headfirst, becoming certified in CPR and first aid, then moving up to become an instructor and later an instructor trainer. Part of my volunteer and later paid Red Cross service was as a first aid team member and leader. That is when I rubbed elbows with county emergency medical technicians, which set my course for the next decade. The Lord works in mysterious ways. Before Sergeant Slaughter stormed the beaches of Iwo Jima, I had been enthralled with paramedics John Gage and Roy DeSoto on the television show Emergency, so my life adjusted to an earlier setting. After completing 3 levels of emergency medical services qualifications and becoming nationally registered, attending the State Fire Academy, accumulating hundreds of hours in specialized training, and becoming certified as one of the first air medical communications specialists in America, I was able to work as a metropolitan EMS paramedic, county fire rescue medic, and safety captain, and ultimately as an EMT team member on an elite helicopter unit at Arkansas Children's Hospital. The Defense Department checked the recruit's vision, but lucky for me back then, the Fire and Emergency Medical Services did not. So, even though classified as legally blind, I managed to sneak through. How did I manage to disguise my failing vision? It wasn't easy, and looking back, not smart. My first field training officer shared his trick after a prior 23 years in Air Force crash rescue. It was to always carry a clipboard, so everyone thinks you're inspecting them. I also allowed my colleagues to believe that I was the world's most prolific collector of flashlights, as I had them on headbands, mounted on my fire helmet, and at least 3 or 4 in my medic kits and pockets. In addition, I determined that if I was promoted faster than anyone else, stayed one of the most qualified medics, and remained the youngest fire captain anyone remembered, I could always be in charge and never get into a situation where my retinas were a problem. One of my better workarounds was taking the opportunity to fill the slot of being the safety captain for my department. This is the officer who stands off to the side and makes sure everyone comes out alive. So I held the rank that benefited me in other settings, but I was able to oversee rather than be on the search or hose teams. Later in my career, when peripheral and night vision were all but gone, I found that working as an emergency medical helicopter communication specialist was a good fit for me. So I was able to complete my decade at minimal risk to anyone. As I alluded to above, I don't recommend my path because it was not the smartest or most transparent way. In fact, it was potentially dangerous. But I'm older and wiser now, and I know of ways in which my blind family and others with disabilities may engage that need to serve. The first option has already been covered, becoming a volunteer at the local American Red Cross chapter. There are multiple ways to volunteer in safety, health, disaster, blood, or volunteer services. I worked multiple natural disasters, military support, family fire in support of the fire department, first aid stations, on mobile blood stations, and even teaching lawnmower safety to kids wanting to work over the summer. Of course, you can become certified in CPR and basic life support and become an instructor, by extension, saving many lives as your students go out and apply their knowledge. Another very valuable way to serve is on your local or county volunteer fire department, where every fire chief is looking for manpower. Even if you're not able to serve on a hose, ladder, or rescue company, although I know of at least one totally blind firefighter who serves on his department's pumper, you can still be an important part of the unit, working in department or station administration, communications, or just helping out around the firehouse. Likewise, city dwellers should research the many support job titles in the local paid first responder agencies, where you can prepare for, apply, interview, and work alongside the frontline personnel in office work, supply and logistics, communications, maintenance, etc. For those who are young, joining an Explorer Scout post may be a very rewarding way to serve, working alongside first responders in the community. All citizens may request to do a ride along with police, fire, and ambulances. Therefore, making connections with managers and command officers and possibly opening up career doors with agencies who have not successfully recruited employees with disabilities. Then there are the two big military auxiliary options, the U.S. Air Force Civil Air Patrol and the U.S. Coast Guard Auxiliary. Both are 100% civilian volunteer managed and staffed without regard to any physical requirements, but you still work under their Defense and Homeland Security Department branches. These squadrons and flotillas are located throughout the country, near most airports, lakes, rivers, and coastal ports, and are always eager to bring in new uniformed volunteers. A simple Google search or USAF CAP That's USAF space CAP or USCG auxiliary in your local area, or research on their national websites will provide plenty of exciting information. The rehab counselor in me would be remiss if I did not suggest state and local civilian service, which is key in providing services we can fill. Examples include working as a Defense Department civilian employee, working on the staff of FEMA, the NTSB, the FBI, or similar state agencies. You may be a candidate for a position I now hold at the U.S. Department of Veterans Affairs, serving those who put their lives out there for all of us. My clients and friends are correct. I am very lucky, actually humbly honored, to have done my duty, although if I had to do it all over again with my current knowledge, I would follow the advice in this article and not my story of fake it until I break it. Many of my peers are now fire chiefs and emergency medical commanders. They are aware that I never told them about my sight loss, but most still do not know that I also was completely deaf in one ear during that decade. They didn't check hearing back then either, but I probably broke the intent of their rules by taking advantage of a loophole. They examine everything now. A satisfying outcome of sharing this article for me would be that each member of my blind and extended disability family who feels that inner need to be in the service of their nation and community finds that pathway and lives out their lives proud to have done their part in making America a better place. In every course I taught, I told every graduating student as I looked them in the eyes and handed them their certificate, just do something. Red, White, and Blind, Your Way If Not My Way Towards Serving, by Kyle Ryan Kipper. Still reading from the Braille Monitor, our final article, Believe It or Not, written by Peggy Chong. From the editor, Peggy Chong provides an interesting service to those of us who are blind and those interested in learning about the blind. Too often we think we have no history, or that the history we do have comes from very extraordinary people whose accomplishments cannot hope to be matched by most of us living in the present and trying to carve out a future. Here, Peggy describes a woman who was given a life, took charge of it, and truly made it the life she wanted. Greetings. Here is a woman I find fascinating. On February 29, 1936, Robert Ripley's Believe It or Not had a guest on his New York City radio program over NBC's WJZ, a concert pianist. Why? What was so special about a concert pianist? She was deaf and blind. Helen May Martin, born 1893, died 1947, began her career as a performer in 1922 in her hometown of Olathe, Kansas. Deaf and blind from early childhood, she liked to push the keys on the family piano and feel the vibrations of others playing while she placed her hands on the piano frame. Her parents, John and Helen Jane Martin, never told their child that she couldn't or that she was limited in any way. Mr. Martin was a traveling salesman for Plow Company. He also loved to play the family piano and sing while holding Helen May on his lap. Her mother was a piano teacher. When young cousins came to visit with the Martin family, Mrs. Martin taught them to play the piano. Helen May and her mother played many games together to make learning fun. When her cousins practiced their piano lessons, she leaned against the piano and felt the vibrations and wanted to learn this game too. Her mother taught her several simple pieces of music. She taught first the right hand part, then the left hand. When Helen May accomplished each part, they put them together. To demonstrate to her the difference between the notes, Mrs. Martin used navy beans. Four beans made a whole note, two beans were a half note, and one bean meant a quarter note. Thus began her understanding of rhythm. Helen May was able to feel the music she played by placing the ball of her foot against the bottom of their upright piano. Over time, she recognized the beauty of each musical piece with its highs, lows, fast, slow, loud, and soft vibrations. When a new piece was introduced, she wanted to know its story to understand the mood of the music. The stories helped her understand the reasons for playing heavier at one point or softer at another. Helen May's mother taught her to keep house, cook, and sew. With the patience of her mother, she took on every task, repeating it over and over until she got each part down. Helen May took the first prize in a local bread-making contest. When her mother opened her store and spent hours sewing dresses for their clients, Helen May did the housework, sweeping floors, cooking meals, washing and ironing. Through the 10 eyes at the end of her fingers, she became an accomplished tatter, an ancient form of making lace. A lady on the streets showed Helen May her tatted hat. She examined every stitch. "I want to do that," Helen May signed to her mother. Mrs. Martin bought the threads and gave Helen May a tatting shuttle. It took months for her to satisfactorily make every stitch, loop, and chain. Over the years, she made table runners, a flag, hats, and bookmarks. The Martins had their own form of communication. Different touches indicated if company was in the room. It was time to eat, time to end a task, or pay attention to directions to walk. Later, the entire family learned American Sign Language rapidly into Helen May's hand. No school would take a deafblind child in Nebraska, Missouri, or Kansas when she turned school age. With little support, her mother was her primary teacher. While still young, Helen May learned to read and write in the New York Point, or NYP, a reading system for the blind, much like Braille. Her mother reached out everywhere for information and assistance. Mrs. Martin signed up her daughter for every magazine for the blind she could find to encourage her to be a better reader. The only library for the blind in Kansas, located at the School for the Blind, served only the students at the school. Mrs. Martin found a way to sign Helen May up as a patron of libraries for the blind in California and Ohio to receive reading material through the mail on a regular basis. Because there was no uniform reading code for the blind in the United States at the time, Helen May learned to read in several different raised formats, along with NYP, such as Braille, raised print, raised music, and moon type. Each library had its own preferred reading methods for the blind. Magazines were written in the format the blind editor read. Her mother taught her to type and encouraged Helen May to write a diary. Some of her diaries still existed 10 years after her death, but no trace of them is found today. She wrote news articles and prose for several magazines for the blind and sighted. In 1912, Helen May wrote to the School for the Deaf in Olathe, Kansas, asking again to be admitted as a student. Neither the Kansas Schools for the Blind or Deaf accepted deaf-blind students, having no specialized teachers nor programs for the deaf-blind. At age 18, she received special permission to attend the Kansas School for the Deaf, older than the typical age at which most students were admitted. The family moved from Greeley, Kansas to Olathe. Teachers came to the Martins' home from the deaf school campus for 1 hour a day. She learned fingerspelling along with the rest of the academic subjects offered. She graduated from the program in 5 years, though most deaf students took 7 or more years to finish. Helen May never had a grade below an A. Before long, she was notating all her music pieces in NYP for her own use. Over 20 years, she transcribed more than 6,000 pieces of music. When Helen May was 20 and her little sister Gertrude only 6, John Martin died, leaving Mrs. Martin to support her children. She opened a millinery store, selling sewing supplies and making dresses for customers. In the spring of 1922, Helen May gave her first professional concert in Olathe. Her goal was to make this her career and become self-supporting for her and her mother. Newspapers from several states ran the story of the deaf-blind pianist. Lions clubs from across the country were so impressed with her story that they asked her to come to their local communities to speak and to perform. For the next 25 years, the Martins traveled across the U.S., performing on radio shows, in concert halls, churches, and schools. No matter where she performed, many doubted that Helen May was deaf-blind. Consequently, many professionals, leaders, and famous people came to her performances asking to meet her. Mrs. Martin, as her manager, sent out their story ahead of each new performance. Editors of local papers thought the story was a hoax and did not print anything in advance of their initial performance outside of an advertisement from the theater or sponsor. They, too, sent a trusted source to the concert to confirm if Helen May was for real. In 1935, Robert Ripley, syndicated cartoonist and radio show host, heard the fantastic story of a deaf-blind pianist. He, too, sent out feelers to determine if Helen May was for real. After meeting her, he booked her for a 14-week tour at his Ripley's Believe It or Not auditorium in New York City in 1936. She appeared on his New York City radio program, also syndicated, bringing Helen May's talent to the nation. Helen May loved to listen to the radio. The president of a radio company invented and made a radio receiver especially for her. It was much like the family radio, but had an attachment, a thin disc of Bakelite, a synthetic plastic, about a foot across, and this was attached to the ordinary radio. It magnified the incoming sounds thrown against the disc, causing it to vibrate. She placed her fingers and thumb flat against the disc to hear the vibrations. Her sense of touch was so keenly developed that she could tell if it was a man or a woman singing or speaking. She recognized many of the pieces she learned and deciphered what kind of instruments were playing. She never stopped learning. Few magazines for the blind were available anywhere. She read almost every one of them. One music publication for the blind was out of France and written in French. Helen May taught herself to read French. The articles and books she read took her to places and described the world in a way her family could not. She took music lessons at universities in Chicago and Cincinnati, receiving a bachelor's degree in music. In the 1930s, she learned to play the harp. When a Wichita banker learned Helen May was learning the harp, he purchased one for her and had it sent to her home. From an early age, her family wanted Helen May to know only the good in the world. Her mother took every opportunity to let her see through touching everything in the home, around the yard, and every new place they went. Mrs. Martin described in great detail the color, sounds, workings, and purpose of each item. She knew every plant in the yard, be it shrub, tree, flower, or vegetable. Her mother described how color affected feelings. Dark clouds could mean sadness. While on vacation, Mrs. Martin was excited to see for her first time the Northern Lights. Helen May asked what they looked like and wrote about it later in her diary, describing the movement of the lights as being like a veil in the wind. Yet she had never seen any of it. She understood its meaning, flow, and emotions. This is an amazing story. So, like the rest of the world at the time, we are challenged to believe it or not. Peggy Chong is a 2023 Jacob Bulletin Award winner. To schedule the Blind History Lady for a presentation for your business, church, or community group, email theblindhistorylady@gmail.com. That's theblindhistorylady@gmail.com. purchase a copy of her book, Don Mahoney, Television Star, at its new low price. Go to don mahoney:television star:chung,peggy:978109808296:amazon.com:books. And please check out my other works at https://www.smashwords.com/books/buy-series/243-25. The title of this article was Believe It or Not by Peggy Chong. Well, that's all the time we have this week for the Braille Monitor. I'm Corrine Hardison for the Virginia Voice. This program is also available on demand at www.virginiavoice.org.